Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. I'm joined by my partner, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at Johns Hopkins School of International Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Elliot, Shana Tova, Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you. Usually you ask how I'm doing, and, you know, the answer today would be, personally, I'm doing just fine. But I really think that the world is going to hell. And maybe we should talk about that in a sort of general way, but with reference to particular places and things. Would you agree?
I do agree. I think we've got, you know, increasing kind of range of disorder around the world. And I think it's worth talking about it, first of all, because we have, for good and sufficient reasons on this podcast, I think, devoted a lot of attention, of course, to the war in Ukraine, some attention to our great power competition with China. Could we just discussed your recent visit to Taipei, for instance. But those subjects have tended to, you know, suck almost all the oxygen out of the room for everything else that's going on in the world. And so I think it would be useful to touch on those things. I think it's also useful to try and see how much those things are connected back to either those big things we've been talking about, because I think in many cases they are, but also to the underlying political dysfunction that we face, you know, in the U.S. I mean, we're about, as we speak, we're about 10 days away from a government shutdown. It's possible that some of the more extreme members of the Freedom Caucus may put forward a motion to vacate the chair, which might drive Kevin McCarthy out of his speakership. But there's just, you know, a lot of dysfunction in American politics. A poll just out, Pew Charitable Trust poll, that shows Americans are thoroughly disgusted and exhausted by American politics. And I have to say that pretty much captures the way I feel. So let's dig into it. So we apparently have dodged a bullet at a potential genocide. Of course, there's a genocide going on in Xinjiang province in China, where the Chinese are kind of waging a kind of continuing campaign against the Uyghur population. But we almost had another genocidal ethnic cleansing going on in Nagorno-Karabakh. And it appears, at least as we're speaking, you know, today, that there's a ceasefire that's been put in place and an agreement that the Armenian militias in that province, which is an exclave of Azerbaijan in Armenia, militias are going to demobilize. But we had a memo circulated by the former judge in the International Criminal Court, former Colombian ambassador to the United States, Luis Moreno Ocampo, basically saying there's a genocide going on potentially in Nagorno-Karabakh. It's about to happen, and nobody in the international community is paying any attention. Should they have been? And, you know, what should they have done?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's, you know, there's a terrible tendency, I think, to return to Chamberlain's, you know, truly horrible formulation, a far off people of whom we know little, which of course he famously said about the Czechs. You know, I think in the case of Nagorno-Karabakh, this was, if I recall, one in which there was a fair amount of injustice on both sides. Originally the Armenians, you know, going back to the original fighting in the wake of the breakup of the Soviet Union, the Armenians had the upper hand, and then gradually the Azeris came back, in part with Israeli and Turkish help. If, you know, if you look at the, I think it's an Armenian enclave.
Exclave.
Exclave, rather, in Azerbaijan.
Yes, I'm sorry. Did I misstate that? If I did, I apologize.
Got it the other way around. You know, the sad thing is, I think the way these things usually have been solved in the past is population transfer. What is striking to me about it is that you begin to see real great power rivalries emerge in this part of the world, where the Armenians used to be able to count on the Russians for support. As you say, everything's connected to everything else. The Russians basically are not there for them, and the Armenians hate that.
Because their peacekeepers have been withdrawn
right.
to go serve in Ukraine.
But you know, it's not clear that the Iranians are happy about the Azeris being on the march.
Right.
And as I said, the Israelis and the Turks are both involved in the side of Azerbaijan. And so I think, you know, what you're going to begin seeing, and I think you're already seeing to some extent in the Caucasus and in Central Asia, is, you know, a return to a very tough form of great power politics, where you have client states that are trying to use the big powers to play off against each other. It's interesting. We have actually engaged in the region in a minor way, and the Europeans have engaged. Whether that'll be a happy outcome or not, I don't know. It is one of those cases where a byproduct of the Russia-Ukraine war has been the destabilization of a different area. And I think, you know, not that I want to say any good thing about Russian so-called peacekeepers, but I suspect that that probably had kept things more or less frozen, which is probably what the Russians wanted to begin with. Well, now looks like that's not happening. So who knows how much further this will go. This is also, I suspect, this is a case where there is an opportunity for American statesmanship to perhaps get some advantage, to insert our influence in an area that otherwise had been pretty much in the thrall of either the Russians or the Iranians, maybe the Turks. Whether we will have the energy to do that, though, or would know how to do that the right way is another matter. I mean, instead, we seem to be expending diplomatic energy in other areas, which I certainly don't think are going to be particularly fruitful. And that, I think, by the way, is part of the larger critique of where American foreign policy is right now. That we're, you know, there are some things we should be focused on, and other things we probably shouldn't be focused on as much as we are.
I agree with that. So, I mean, first of all, you're right to highlight the fact that this flare-up of the earlier conflict. I mean, there was a war in the 90s. We then had a effort which ended up pretty much in a fairly sweeping Armenian victory, and a lot of ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh of its Azeri population. There was then this 2020 war that took place while we were in the throes of COVID that nobody noticed, which with a lot of support from Turkey and some from Israel, the Azeris were able to, you know, recoup a lot of what they had lost, pretty much everything they had lost to the Armenians.
And drones played a very large role in that, by the way. I mean, that was really, in some ways, a precursor to what we've seen in Ukraine.
Absolutely. And as you say, there's a, you know, Armenian or an Iranian connection here, too, because of their concerns about Azeri separatism in the northeast of northwest of Iran. So you're right, I think, to highlight the fact that we could see more of this, not just in the Caucasus, but in Central Asia, where Russian influence is now kind of draining away. And you see little signs of it coming up in Central Asia. But I guess I would say stay tuned. You know, more we could see much more in this area. But you mentioned Iran, which is, I think, a good opportunity to segue into a couple of dimensions of Iran. One is, of course, the agreement to unfreeze $6 billion in Iranian assets held by the South Koreans in order to get a number of Americans, actually dual nationals, who've been held unjustly by Iran. You know, the administration has been at great pains to say this is not a ransom. And that we're committed to getting, you know, Americans unjustly detained home. And that's certainly a you know, a desirable thing, obviously, for those individuals and their families in particular, but in general. But there is no way, I think, you can, you know, look at this as anything other than a ransom.
I mean,
full disclosure, I testified against the precursor deal that was reached in 2016, where I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we were talking about something like $1.2 billion, but the ante is clearly being upped, you know, because this was now $6 billion that was back to the Iranians. And of course, money is fungible. So you can say, well, they're only going to spend it on humanitarian things, but that $6 billion right. they would have had to spend on humanitarian things otherwise, that they're going to clearly spend on bad things. So, I mean, what's your take on all of that?
Well, you know, the thing that first, I had exactly the same reaction that you know, that $6 billion that just went into the pockets of the Iranian government, they're not going to use it for good purposes. It got us zero goodwill. I think the next day the Iranians were back to bashing us.
And kicking out IAEA inspectors.
Right. And I think, there are two dimensions. First, just on the American dimension, seems to me there are a number of areas, and Taiwan, as we discussed last week, is one, but this is another where we just lie to ourselves. And maybe, you know, I've never been able to figure out, your government experience is vaster than mine. Do people, when they say those things, actually believe them? Because it, on the surface of it, it's preposterous. I mean, you really, there has to be a kind of willing disbelief to convince yourself of that. And so I think it was a big mistake. But I think the other thing is the evolution of the Iranian problem is one more in a whole set of problems that the United States is going to have to grapple with. Because on the one hand, it's clear the Iranians are benefiting from the fact that the Russians need them for drones and probably other military technologies. That Ukraine war, again, the knock-on effects has kind of reinforced a de facto alliance between the Russians and the Ukrainians, which will have consequences. The Iranians continue to be, you know, very proficient at this sort of hybrid warfare stuff. On the other hand, they've got a weak economy, and they're going to have a succession crisis that nobody seems to have anticipate. I mean,
and the public largely despises the right. theocracy.
So, you know, who knows? Have we been carefully anticipating what might happen when the supreme leader goes? I tend to doubt it. I think we'll kind of react in the moment. But who knows whether, you know, will there be an opening to Iran depending on what kind of leadership you get? Or are you going to get leadership that is in some ways even worse? It may be an opportunity, or alas, it may be even worse. I mean, you may get an Iranian government that says, okay, now's the time to go for broke on nuclear weapons. So, you know, it's another tremendous source of instability. I guess the last thing I would say is, you know, it struck me now for some time that we, after the miserable experience of Iraq, for reasons I fully understand, the dominant impulse in the United States government was to get the hell out of the Middle East. And I think we're just learning, you know, you can't. I mean, you just can't disregard what's happening in that part of the world because, again, everything's connected to everything else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, you know, the Iranians and Russians are now exchanging military technology and equipment. Iranian drones, which the Russians are now trying to replicate, build inside Russia, that they're using against Ukraine. You know, the president yesterday at the United Nations General Assembly, in his speech, once again said, as all of his predecessors have back to Bill Clinton, you know, the Iranians cannot be allowed to get a nuclear weapon. But, you know, the administration came into office saying we want to get back to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was negotiated in the Obama administration, which was American participation was ended by Donald Trump. They wanted to get back in, but they wanted it to be a longer and stronger agreement because a number of the timelines in the original agreement were rapidly approaching, you know, including an end to the UN embargo on military transfers to Iran. So the administration engaged in a lot of diplomacy. It basically said there is no military option. That was something that Rob Malley, the negotiator, said in testimony to the Congress multiple times. We don't believe there's a military option.
Which mysteriously disappeared, by the way.
Well, he was under investigation for his handling of classified information. We don't know the details of that, but the FBI is involved, so it sounds like it's fairly serious. Details about the investigation are mysteriously showing up on the website of the English language Tehran Times, which is a media outlet associated with the regime. It's all very peculiar. But the point I was going to make is the administration said there's only diplomacy. There is no military solution. But they've now said we're not really negotiating about the JCPOA anymore. And Brett McGurk, that was attributed to him in the New York Times the other day, which makes you wonder what they're actually doing. It sort of, from a policy point of view, suggests that they've reached the null set. There's no, you know, there's no military solution, but there's not really a diplomatic solution. It does sound like what they're looking for is a kind of informal, unwritten agreement that would somehow limit the Iranians, keep them below 60% enrichment, and that prevents the Biden administration having to present anything to Congress because the law says they must present any agreement to the Congress. But it also, I think, means that you're de facto accepting Iran as a threshold nuclear power. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that's right. I mean, it's all that stuff is the triumph of hope over experience. I think that you can. It's something we've discussed before that. That belief that hits a lot of people in government that there's some complicated, subtle thing that skirts the law and has lots of moving parts which can make a problem go away. And that I don't think either of us think that's the nature of international affairs. I have one question, though, just to go back to the Russia-Iran angle, because it's going to tie into the Russia-North Korean angle, which we'll talk about in a little bit. How much do you think, I mean, it's clear the Russians are desperate for certain kinds of arms. And they also probably want some of their own allies, given that they're becoming a dependency of China in certain respects. What do you think they'd be willing to give the Iranians? And in particular, do you think they might be willing to give the Iranians nuclear technology or nuclear delivery technology?
It's a tricky question, particularly when you say delivery technology. So do I think the Russians would actually help the Iranians with sort of weaponization, creation of a warhead, et cetera? No, I don't. And in part, I think they don't need to because, you know, as you know from our government service, there's plenty of evidence that the IAEA has put forward that the Iranians had made great strides, you know, on that in that regard already in form of their so-called past military dimensions of their program. But will they help them with their ballistic missile and space capabilities? And those are very hard to distinguish from one another, right? Because if you solve the problem of staging a missile to put it into Earth orbit for, you know, space purposes, it also happens to solve the staging problem if you want to have a multi-stage ballistic missile, including one capable of reaching not only large parts of Europe, but potentially all the way to, you know, continental United States. So yes, I think they would help them with delivery from that point of view, but not, you know, weaponization of a warhead or miniaturization, those kinds of things. At least that's my suspicion, but who knows?
I mean, I hope so. I think the fear is that the knock-on, again, these knock-on effects from Ukraine could be pretty pernicious. I also think that the Iran problem may explain some of the peculiar sense of urgency that the administration has in going for a Israeli-Saudi deal. And let me just open the conversation on that one. This, again, seems to be one of those really complicated endeavors, which is just not going to succeed because, you know, first you're dealing with two very difficult leaders, both the Saudi Crown Prince and Bibi Netanyahu, both of whom have a variety of issues. In case of Bibi, also a very insecure domestic base, but MBS has to worry about his domestic base too. Neither of whom I think are completely straightforward and trustworthy. And what I, for the life of me, I don't understand why we're investing so much effort in this. Because, look, they've had under the table connections and conversations for a long time now. They can negotiate without us. You know, there are other countries like the UAE or Jordan that, you know, can offer their good offices. And I have always believed in a form of policy physics, which is that at any given time, there's only a fixed amount of policy energy in the system. And if you're working on one thing, that means you're spending less time on other things, in this case, Ukraine and China. Because at the end of the day, you know, the actual decision-making and the diplomatic heavy lifting is done by a pretty small group of people and includes a Secretary of State, maybe an undersecretary here or there, a national security advisor, or the president themselves. Well, those people need to get, you know, they need 8 hours of sleep at night. They need to work out. They need an occasional day off. They just don't have, their time and energy is not infinitely elastic. And so I don't understand why they're sluicing all that effort into this one. And I have only two explanations for it, and then I'll stop and ask what you think. One is that they somehow think this is a way of dealing with the Iran thing. But the other is that they're simply succumbing to that age-old siren, which is the idea that I'm going to bring, you know, Arab-Israeli peace. When in fact, the real initiatives, beginning with Sadat's visit to Israel, comes from within the region, and it comes from the actors themselves. I mean, I think that was true, by the way, of the Abraham Accords.
Absolutely.
That it was the, you know, the UAE and the Israelis, and yes, we helped a bit at the end, but that's all we did. So, I don't know. What do you think?
So first, let me stipulate a few things, right? Number one, I think it would be an extremely good thing for there to be a follow-on to the Abraham Accords in the form of Saudi-Israeli normalization. I think that would be good for everybody. I've been a signatory to a report that recommended it at the beginning of the administration. And I also need to stipulate that I was critical at the outset of the administration about their coming in full bore to, you know, re-engage with the Iranians while holding our Gulf allies sort of at, you know, at one remove, you know, and that was in the form, first of all, of Biden's statements that he was going to turn MBS into a pariah, the delisting of the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, which was meant to be an opening towards peace in Yemen. Instead, it became an opening to the Houthis droning and rocketing Abu Dhabi and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
About which we did very little.
At which we did nothing. You know, and then, of course, the administration discovered that they actually needed the Saudis to keep the price of oil down after the war in Ukraine started, and they wondered why, you know, the Saudis weren't all that, you know, receptive. So I have all those views. Now, having said that, I share your skepticism about this particular initiative. And I share it because, to me, you know, the degree of difficulty, if this were Olympic diving, you know, the degree of difficulty is really incredible here. Because here are the things that they have to do to make this all work. One, they will have to get a treaty with a security guarantee for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and presumably a parallel treaty for Israel through the United States Senate. I think you could probably get 67 votes for a treaty with Israel in the Senate. Maybe. Not sure. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's a sure thing, but I think you could do it. Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, this is a Congress, you know, the previous Congress with the composition wasn't that different. You know, a couple of swings in Senate seats and House seats, voted against giving aid to Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen. But now they're going to vote for a treaty that in perpetuity commits the United States to defend the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, presumably with our nuclear umbrella and perhaps with boots on the ground. I'm not sure I see that in the cards. I mean, and in my view, nothing could be worse than for the administration to go down this path and then have it fail in the United States Senate. Think back to Woodrow Wilson and the failure of the Treaty of Versailles. A treaty failure like this would be catastrophic, yes, in my view, for our other alliance relationships. As would, by the way, some of what you hear privately from the administration, that, well, Article 5 is not really a commitment. You know, it's a commitment to consult. It's not a casus federis. Doesn't immediately, you know, commit us to war. Having that kind of debate, by the way, will destabilize all our existing alliances in NATO with our East Asian allies, etc. So that's point one. Point two, the Saudis are also asking for essentially access to the full nuclear fuel cycle as part of the nuclear energy program in a so-called Section 123 agreement with the United States to provide that assistance. And they're doing that, of course, because we conceded that to the Iranians in the JCPOA. Other countries like the UAE signed a 123 agreement that, you know, forswore access to the entire fuel cycle. But there's a kind of, I think, huge potential non-proliferation moral hazard issue here, which is, you know, we gave a security guarantee to Japan and Germany, you know, after World War II. But part of that, you know, deal was what our colleague at SAIS, Frank Gavin, has called a strategy of inhibition, right? Which was we gave them a guarantee precisely so they wouldn't develop nuclear weapons. Here we may be giving a security guarantee to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia only to find out that they are developing a nuclear weapon. And so there is that. The third kind of moving part of this that I find a little suspect is the notion that somehow this agreement will be part of our strategic competition with China because the Saudis will be signing up for our side, not the other side in this competition. How you memorialize and enforce that, I have no idea. And I can easily imagine the people in the Biden administration who are talking about this, talking themselves into this only to find themselves being thoroughly snookered by MBS on this problem. Fourth problem that I see is there is an element here inside the administration, I think, that is got sugar plum fairies dancing in their head about what I would call regime change in Israel, that somehow they are, you know, going to use this prospect of normalization with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to get Bibi Netanyahu to make some concessions to the Palestinians, which is one of the asking prices from MBS, that will cause his coalition to fail and create a new government in Israel, either with or without Bibi. Again, I think Bibi will run rings around these people, and yep. I just don't see it happening. And then finally, you know, one of the reasons, which never gets discussed, about why we went to war in Iraq in 2003 was that the large-scale presence of U.S. forces in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia since the end of the Gulf War was driving radicalization and recruitment for al-Qaeda. And that was one of his main, was bin Laden's main complaint in his fatwas, was the desecration of the land of the two holy mosques by the presence of infidels, including women, on the territory of the kingdom. So the administration is going to have to figure out, you know, what happens the day after the United States Senate, if it ever did, ratifies an Article 5 with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What's General Carrilla, the commander of CENTCOM, going to come in and say, I need to have the following things if I need to be prepared to fight tonight to defend the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right? And that is going to drive them off their, you know, effort to reorient and I'm not going to say pacing threat because I know how you feel about that, but to reorient our forces to deal with the serious challenge we face in the Indo-Pacific when they're going to have to, you know, deploy more forces, you know, into the theater and maybe into the kingdom, which will then create a lot of this, you know, radicalization dynamic again. So to me, solving all these problems, oh, by the way, in a presidential election year, I don't see it.
Well, that may be one of the reasons to want to do it, too, that, you know, if you're feeling domestically pressured, the foreign policy people, I think, usually feel pretty useless during a campaign season. And
for good reason, because they are.
They are. but, you know, so this may seem like a attractive thing. I find it all baffling. I think, you know, I mean, your reasons laid it out much better than I could. I will just say that, you know, partly because we're in a period right now where a lot of structures seem to be under pressure, there is a temptation to resort to guarantees and to try to kind of restabilize the system by saying, well, we'll give so-and-so an Article 5, so-and-so an Article 5. Now, in some cases, I think we probably need to do that. I think Ukraine really is one. But to do it to a place which...
Agree.
You cannot count on the stability of Saudi Arabia. You cannot count on its discretion, on its level-headedness when you need it to be level-headed. And I just, it seems to me to be cuckoo.
Before we leave it, Elliot, let me say, if they could solve, to my satisfaction, the five issues I laid out and explain to me how they're going to do it, I'm open to it.
Don't hold your breath.
I just think it's a very high bar to get there.
It is a very high bar, and I'll stand by my point, which is these guys have other things that they should be doing with their time.
Yeah, I agree.
They really do. So let's bring this closer to our own hemisphere, which, you know, it's I think it's fair to say that by and large, foreign policy people like us have, on the whole, tended to ignore our own hemisphere. And that's partly because we didn't have to worry about it that much, but also sheer ignorance and partly, you know, Eurocentrism and other things of that kind. So there are two things. So one, just an immediate story up north, and then I think we should talk about south of the border, which we've really not talked about on the podcast. So the Canadians and Indians are getting into a real tiff because the Canadians are basically accusing the Indians of having killed a Sikh separatist on Canadian soil. And I, you know, maybe this is a passing issue, but I think this is actually pretty significant for a couple of reasons. One is, look, the Indians are being more assertive in a variety of ways. India is, I think, quite deliberately trying to position itself on the world stage, but it's not clear to me that it's, and I think it's going to position itself in a pretty assertive way. Some of the ways we won't like are natural instinct seems to be to appease them on the ground that we need them on side for China, but I don't quite get that since they're the ones who have a chunk of their national territory under Chinese occupation and are, you know, threatened with being surrounded by the Chinese. So that seems to me to be a mistake. But on the other hand, you also have, you have had in Europe, and I think you may have had in Canada, you know, really people being willing to give sanctuary to terrorists, which is sort of what it sounds like this guy might have been. And in any case, the United States is finding itself in this awful position where we have to choose between one of our closest allies, neighbors, NATO member, you know, fellow more or less functioning democracy, and a rising India. And there's a similar dilemma that they face with Saudi Arabia. You know, do you just sort of forget Khashoggi and all that. And so the larger issue of values in American foreign policy as opposed to our interests, I think it is being surfaced by all this. So I think for that reason, this story is actually a rather important one.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've you know, read the press accounts. I've seen what Justin Trudeau has said. I wonder whether, I don't know, you know, how much the Canadian government did behind the scenes before Trudeau spoke out. It might have been worthwhile maybe engaging the Indians privately before you went public on this. I just don't know enough. I guess, I mean, I'm not willing to, say that anything is, inconceivable. But I would say that we have seen an uptick around the world of efforts by a variety of different governments to kill or render regime opponents home in ways that we have not seen, on this scale in the past. And I do think it's a symptom of the broader kind of growing global disorder that we've been talking about. But I mean, I know you've seen the stories of these so-called, stations, security stations. Yep. That the PRC supposedly has created in like New York City and elsewhere to keep track of overseas Chinese people or to deal with, quote, the enemies of China. I mean, there's a pretty clear case in New Zealand, which I think I know you're aware of, with Anne Marie Brady, a scholar who pretty clearly had her office tossed by agents of the Ministry of State Security in China because she's written extensively about Chinese hybrid warfare and so-called, magical tools. I can't remember the exact term she uses, but that the Chinese have put a lot of emphasis on. The government of Turkey, the Iranians, there are a lot of governments that are doing this, authoritarian governments that are going after their opponents. And of course, under Modi, India has taken a more authoritarian turn, although it remains, a functioning democracy of sorts, at least, electorally. So I don't know. I just don't know enough about this particular case to, render a judgment, but it does seem to me to be part of a larger trend that's alarming. And I'm not quite sure how we put that back in the box.
I think it's true. And I think part of the problem is that I'm not sure we've ever really responded particularly aggressively. Other things have happened. There've been Russian dissidents who've died mysteriously in the U.S., even in here in Washington, D.C. And, yeah. Of course, the Brits had
self-administered blunt force trauma.
Yeah, right. And I think, this is part of a larger challenge to American statecraft, which is we're going to have to be tougher and more transactional with certain states. And not just ignore these things, which is what our tendency has been to do, but really exact serious costs from them. And I don't mean sanctions. I mean things which are more painful than that. But it's worrying. What's just as worrying, probably even more worrying, is what's happening south of the border. We've had a Ecuadorian presidential candidate get shot. After a time where it looked like the Venezuelan dictatorship would collapse, it's not. Mexico really has, as far as I can tell, a pretty terrible left-wing government. And what's worse is you just have a sense of, pretty broad breakdowns in law and order. There's something similar happening in Colombia, again, under a left-wing president who may have been a former terrorist. That's all that you have. Lula back in Brazil, and I don't know that Brazil is falling apart, but I do know that he's going out of his way to be oppositional to the United States.
Right.
You just kind of worry about that continent, and there's probably not a whole lot we can do to change it. But I suppose it is the case we should probably stop neglecting it.
I agree. And I mean, I think when you add, not just Mexico, but Central America into the mix, you've got a combination of factors that are driving two very important domestic kind of concerns. You know, one is drugs and fentanyl. We just had a horrendous case in New York City. You know, a lot of this fentanyl is coming in, you know, through the Mexican border. And then, of course, immigration. And, you know, those two issues are driving a lot of concern in the United States about our politics and about, you know, what government is doing about it. And I fear that the Biden administration is kind of whistling past the graveyard here. I mean, they're acting as if there's no problem at the border, you know, and look, border entries go up and they go down. And, you know, sort of when they go down, the administration says, oh, look, you know, our border policies are working. And then if they, you know, go up, they look the other way. And it's really driving, you know, political concern in states like Texas and the other border states. It's now becoming an issue because Texas and Florida and others are sending some of these migrants. I mean, I decry the use of these people as pawns, but the fact that they're, you know, now showing up in New York is creating a problem in New York. I mean, Joe Biden met with a lot of people when he went up to the UN General Assembly session, but one of them was not Eric Adams, the mayor of New York, because even though he's a Democrat, they're not on very good terms, in part because of this issue. So, I'm not sure, again, like you, I'm not sure what the answer is, but certainly neglect can't be the right answer.
No, on the immigration front, I mean, there are two separable issues. One is the sort of chaotic governance in Central and parts of Latin America. That's one set of issues. Immigration is another one. I think they actually on both sides, some of us have probably been remiss in failing to talk about immigration, honestly. You and I are both descendants of immigrants. I mean, everybody here is a descendant of immigrants other than Native Americans. And even they probably came over across the Bering Strait. But, you know, the fact is that once you get to some percentage of the population being recent immigrants, you know, history would tell you that you get trouble, that you have, previous populations feeling displaced and so on. And in this case, I think it's worsened really by a sense of lawlessness, that this, you know, this is really not going through in a legal and orderly way. And I think it's turned out to be very difficult for both parties to deal with that. And, you want to square the American dream, because there's absolutely no question of the enormously positive role that immigration plays in terms of, you know, our vitality, our dynamism, our demography. On the one hand, on the other hand, you know, to think that unrestrained immigration is okay, that's not true either. And unfortunately, you know, I can't really think of a single politician who's addressing it head on. But maybe that's just part of the larger problem with American politics.
So the late John McCain, I think, you know, tried to on a couple of occasions. Yep. President Bush, 43, tried to on a couple of occasions. Both of them ultimately failed. Look, I mean, we need immigration, right? Maybe a lot of American industries are facing enormous labor shortages. Our own birth rate is dropping. We do need to have immigration. But as you say, we need, you know, a orderly, reasonable process that allows the immigration to take place. And I think everybody agrees that that's not what we have now. And that I think is a huge problem. And the fact that our political system seems totally incapable of dealing with it. The last time we had I could be wrong about this because I'm not an expert on immigration. I know our colleague Linda Chavez at Bulwark would, you know, have a better idea about this. But the last major piece of legislation, I believe, was the Immigration Act of 1965.
Yeah,
I think we're still operating under essentially a 60-year-old immigration law when the conditions around the world have changed, obviously, dramatically.
Well, so let's try to kind of not conclude this, but bring it nearer to the end with a question about at the heart of this, I think, is American politics and how American politics affects our ability to act in the world. Now, I will say, to a certain extent, you know, despite the enormous dysfunction we've been able to act reasonably effectively where it mattered most, I think, in Europe and in the Indo-Pacific up to a point. But that said, there are plenty of things that are really problematic and troubling. Do you think that this is just a passing phase? And I'll be even more pointed. Do you think that, look, once Trump and Biden are both out of the picture, you'll have a new generation of leaders and the country will revert to more of what you and I would think of as normal?
I don't know. You know, because I could argue it round or flat. You know, I could argue that, well, first of all, it's clear that the public is about to get a rematch that it fervently does not want.
It's astounding, isn't it?
It's just, you know, it's clear every poll shows that, you know, a large majority of Americans, including Democrats, do not want to see a replay of 2020. That they would, and speaking myself as a septuagenarian, I think it's time for the septuagenarians to get off the stage and let younger people take their, you know, proper roles in governing our country. But having said that, I'm not at all confident. I mean, I think the country is deeply divided. I'm not at all confident that either party can create a stable governing majority right now. You know, Sarah Longwell, our Bulwark colleague and the publisher of the Bulwark, has said, and I agree with her, you know, the problem is we have one party that's becoming an authoritarian threat to democracy and another party that's just not very good at politics. And that is a huge, huge problem. And for a democracy that's been a two-party system, you know, for the entirety of the Republic's existence. Well, that's a little bit of an overstatement. There were not two parties at the outset, and there have been brief periods where there was only one real party, and then there was Reconstruction, et cetera. So that's a bit of an overstatement, but this is fundamentally has been a two-party system in this country. And I don't know that either party right now is capable of you know, creating what I would call a governing majority. I mean, we've had divided government in the Congress for a long time. We've had multiple elections where the winner of the popular vote either didn't, you know, win the Electoral College or was a real close run thing. I mean, I think the only time that the Republicans have actually had a popular vote majority was in 2004.
Yeah. No, I agree. I guess since, you know, I'd like to end this on a more hopeful note. I guess I continue to be convinced that most Americans are actually reasonably moderate, that there are, you know, minorities out there at both ends of the spectrum, particularly on the right these days, but not just on the right, who are really hold extreme beliefs. But I don't think that's where most of the country is. I mean, and I think there's a reason why most people are kind of turned off from politics. It's not what any of us like. What I wish I had a better sense of is how we break through this. And, you know, maybe it's only when the current generation goes and you get a new generation of, I don't know, governors from both parties or something else. But I guess I find it difficult to believe that this can go on forever. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I think what worries me is it seems to me that we have the electoral coalitions of both parties kind of disaggregating, right? So Democrats are losing working class, non-college educated voters to the Republicans. And now whether that's just a Trump phenomenon or whether that's a more broad-based, I don't know. I just don't know. We'll have to see. Meanwhile, extremism on the Republican side, including on things like abortion rights and other issues, is, you know, driving college-educated voters out of the Republican Party and you know, voting for Democrats. We've seen that in the 2018, 20, and 22 cycles. But I don't know that gives you, you know, I'm not sure sort of what the net is and, you know, what the net assessment is of who ends up with a governing coalition who can control the Congress and the executive and actually, you know, govern the country without these perpetual crises over, you know, the debt limit or funding the government or all the other things that, you know, we have this incredibly performative politics that has nothing to do with governing. You know, and we've now got this, you know, sort of impeachment inquiry going against Biden. And there's a very large, not a large, but there is a majority, according to recent polling, that supports it, even though there doesn't seem to be any evidence whatsoever that Biden's done anything wrong. Although his son is obviously a very sleazy guy, but there you have it. I'm sorry. It's just hard for me to, you know, be upbeat or optimistic.
Well, all I can think of is the end of one of the stories by the great Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem, where he says, "But enough of me talking about my troubles. Let's talk about happier things. Tell me about the outbreak of cholera in Odessa."
All right.
Well, to our listeners, we'll try to cheer you up next time somehow.
We'll try and figure that out between now and then, but for the moment, that will be all for this episode of Shield of the Republic. Thanks for allowing Elliot and me to depress you with this discussion of global chaos.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.